sometimes monasteries and monks and are kind of austere, kind of scary figures and stuff. And it's never been the, when you see a Buddha image, there's always a slight smile on his face. He's never a scary figure. So I thought I had to make it a little more friendly and intimate around the monastery, so I usually call people, I put Pi on the end of their name. You can't, when somebody calls you Tessie Pi or Billy Pi or whatever, they call me Sona Pi. So it just, you know, atmospheres, you need to set an atmosphere and always work at an atmosphere. If you just assume that people just show up to any situation and will catch on, it's not true. You have to show it in how you speak, the tone of your voice, how you converse, what you do for each other. It kind of has to be expressed all the time. And I also like to, you know, because calling somebody, that's a childlike thing. And it's about affection and playfulness as well. So the spiritual path is not necessarily, you know, grim and austere, but it can be. People find it that way. In fact, they find life that way. It can be difficult, and you can get awfully serious. It can get unrelieved grayness to it and things like that. And but, you know, it's just a little attitudinal change, and you're just a step away from stepping out into the sunshine from behind the shadow of a rock, you know. So it's what I learned in my life. And I these similes and little attitude teachings and everything I've learned also from my affiliation with spiritual groups and monastic groups and monk teachers and lay teachers, etc. So that's why, that's the history of Pi. Well, today is through a garden gate. How to open a garden gate. I think, isn't it? What were the words exactly? I couldn't.
The art.
The art. Yeah, it's an art as well. I know it's really not just a don't just muscle it open. it won't work. It's latched. There is an art to it. And this is a beautiful setting for talking about gardens as well. All you can see is me and a blank white wall. I get to see you and a beautiful, lush, green forest out there, a gardened forest, a cultivated forest. It's partly natural, but there's also flowers and things. So this is, we all find this so beautiful. I don't know anybody who doesn't rejoice in the garden. We all have our favorite types. And maybe, you know, we have our favorite types, but other types are not bad either. So my favorite literal garden is a carefully cultivated Japanese-style garden. Whenever I go to Portland, I subtly hint that it would be nice to go to their marvelous Zen garden there, Japanese garden. There are five gardens within that 5 acres. I just appreciate the aesthetics. They have the sense of the natural. It's sort of, it's carefully cultivated, but at the same time, it feels very natural. And when you leave, you don't really know what's happening to you. And it's when you leave, you realize you've just had a brain massage. That you feel something has been removed from you in a very subtle way. You're not really conscious of it while it's happening. But those are outer gardens, and it's great to recognize the interaction between the exterior world around us, the world of the senses, and then in its relationship to the interior world. The Buddha was very big on nature and the importance of it for helping the mind towards serenity. And he himself was not through any effort on his own part. He happened to be born in the forest. His mother was traveling. His mother was royalty, and she was traveling between two palaces and was pregnant, and she had to stop and had the baby under a tree. And there's lots of paintings around Asia of the Buddha being born. She's standing, actually, standing, hanging onto a branch. That's a very interesting way of giving birth. And then the devas, the angels, catch the Buddha. Actually, at that time, he's not the Buddha. He's the Bodhisattva. He's not born as a Buddha. That's something that you attain as a fully grown adult through your own personal efforts with great maturity. It's not something that just is handed to you. And but he is has a certain development and destiny. At that time, as a baby, he's referred to as the Bodhisattva, a light seeker, you know, seeker of a being of light, one who is seeking light. And then eventually he realizes that light finding. So the, let's come in and just have a seat. You know. Yeah, find a seat. There should be one over there. So he's born in the forest. At 28, he leaves the palace. 29, he leaves the palace for the forest and spends the next 6 years. And then awakens again under a tree, another birth under a tree. It's a new birth. In this life, of course, we have many. I don't have to give an esoteric idea about reincarnation. I'm sure all of you know that you have lived and died many times in this life and shed some aspects of yourself and have come into new identities. And that's really the critically important realization, is that, you know, we're not a fixed ball of metal or something like this, that we're flexible, flowing, we're rivers of consciousness and experience and memories and plans and identities. We're not just an identity, we're identities flowing. And it's surprising, as you canoe down this river, what's around the bend sometimes, you know. Sometimes you get into a lagoon or into some rapids. And what was beautiful, tranquil river, where maybe you were drifting down that river, and then suddenly it starts to get lively, and you're not sure you're going to get through those rapids sometimes. These are all continuous streaming events of birth and death, of aspects of ourselves. And those kind of births and deaths are the ones that are relevant to us. The mere fact of death, the mere sort of when a body falls down and they drop it in the ground or whatever, not really a very interesting event. You go to the funeral, whatever, but that, of course, the person, whoever that was, lives on, of course, vividly in your consciousness, and you can And I'm still talking to my grandfather sitting around, you know, and my grandmother and all kinds of people that have passed along, and they're just alive in their ongoing relationships. And so the mind is really timeless, doesn't have regard for these kind of events in a very literal way. It functions in a very symbolic and timeless. It jumps through time. And so that's actually the most important reality, or the outside objective scientific reality is not that important. It's kind of good for guiding a rocket to the moon or something, but not for the way we actually live in the important way in with our lives or within us. this, the Buddha then awakened under the tree. And there's stories. Now, these are not necessarily in the suttas, in the original discourses. But there's all kinds of wonderful and wondrous stories woven around this. The artists get a hold of this. The poets get a hold of these events, and they dramatize them for us, and so forth. So they have the Buddha later on spending a few weeks just expressing gratitude, or more or less radiating gratitude to the tree that was shading him at the time of his awakening. So he comes to the end of his voyage into the unknown. He doesn't know when he starts it that he will ever come out the other side of this voyage. It's not, nobody tells him, in 6 years you graduate from high school, it's over, you're done, then you get a job, it's all taken care of. It's like going to high school, you're not sure. You doubt yourself, you wonder, is there, what happens? What happens to the hero at the end of this story? And you are all the hero. The one thrust into a voyage. You know, this is to be born, to be, well, to become conscious as at 2 or 3 or 4, whatever age you awaken, to realize you're in the world, you're flung into the world, and you're on this voyage, which is a very strange voyage because you can't see ahead, you can only see behind. It's like climbing a mountain and facing backwards. You cannot see the future, but you can see the past. So it's a strange voyage into uncertainty. And you don't have a choice. You must do it. So the Buddha is you. You are the Bodhisattva. You are the Buddha. It's a journey for him to resolve some gnawing issues that just wouldn't let him alone. It just insisted that he had to do some somewhat unusual things, some things that maybe he would rather not do, but he just couldn't be at ease or at peace if he didn't. And there's no certainty that he would find the answer. And this is the way it feels in our lives as well. We do go on these voyages. You're going to a retreat. You're exploring intellectually and emotionally. And we cannot really stop doing this. We're driven to do this because we could stop, but it would never be satisfactory. In my own particular path, when I started meditating and so forth, I found that I didn't really know what I was looking for. It caught my interest, and I began to meditate, and I didn't know what the effects would be either. But somehow something began to happen, and it was rather strange because you kind of can lose your previous conditioning in some ways, and you're not who you were, and that can be very inconvenient. It's like losing your wallet in a strange country, and or being shipwrecked in a strange country or something, you can't get back. And sometimes I would, and so a little voice tells you, you're no longer interested in that, by the way. It won't do it for you anymore. And then you say, but I spent years doing this. I mean, this was what I thought would make me happy. And the voice just comes back and says, I'm sorry. It's just very realistic. It just won't give in. It's like a bureaucrat. It just won't give you your landed immigrant status, you know. I just, sorry, I'm not giving you back your passport. And it can't really force you to do anything. It can only deny you your ease. All it can do is confiscate your sense of ease. And it says, until you do what I'm suggesting, you really won't. The taste, the tastiness of your life is being withdrawn. So you must go. And everybody has it in different ways, but it is an invitation or into the unknown. Do I have to go into the unknown again? I thought I had this arranged nicely. So this is the events of the Buddha. He's doing this in nature, though. You know, he's finding that nature is supportive in a way that the artificiality of the human construction is distracting, and we just need a calm and it's a kindly kind of background that nature, the trees and the birds. You can hear these birds out there. We picked a beautiful time to do this. You hear those birds? So this is the then the Buddha then died in the forest as well. He died between two sal trees, and you see the Buddha lying on his right side in the parinirvana posture, the about to enter nirvana posture, is famously depicted throughout Asia. The reclining Buddha. We have a sitting Buddha here. He's still in good health. He's still fairly young. But he's not out of touch with reality. He knows that one day I'll be just lying on the ground and dying, and I'd like to do it in nature between two trees, you know. So he was born in the forest. He practiced in the forest. He awakened in the forest. He continued to live in the forest, and then he died in the forest. And he also expressed very clearly to monks and nuns that go to the forest, monks, live in the forest. It is a good environment for the practice. So the forest is outward, but it's also a simile. We could use it two ways. He referred to when we go on our spiritual journey that there's a wilderness, a jungle of views and opinions out there. When we start inquiring, reading books and different traditions and trying to compare, and then this philosophy, then we get onto this, and we're doing different things, and it becomes quite a, we start to realize it's a forest of views, a jungle, a thicket of views. So he has experience also with the confusion of being lost in forests. But at the same time, there's the joy of practice, lucid practice in the groves, the gardens, the monastery is called the Sitavana. Sitavana Arama is what they would call it. So we you know, when you start using words like monasteries and stuff, you already, what flickers up is probably a film of the 12th century stone monastery with Saint Francis in it or something. But it's a very, not that monastery. It's a different tradition and a different idea. So what it really says is Sitavana is a cool grove. It's a cool grove where people go to be in the shade and get out of the heat. And then this Arama means just like a community. The real name where monks live is called a Vihara, meaning a dwelling where, and we're not monks, we're something else called bhikkhus. So the cool grove where bhikkhus, who are a sort of just spiritual aspirants, dwell in a garden. So, you know, with language, we need to make our language express our deepest aspirations for beauty, because it really is the ultimate beauty. So that, what is the in our English language, the ultimate beauty is freedom from suffering, but not merely the absence of suffering. That could be a very neutral kind of, if you're in a coma, you're not suffering very much, but it's not much beauty there either. So it's the arriving from the voyage from the unsatisfactory to the entirely satisfactory. And that's a project of gardening. It's not, it doesn't really involve much in the external ways, except some, you know, very critically, friends. So you have a gardening club, gardening society, weight loss society, stuff like that. I mean, it's just peer support. And all of you here have been taught for multiple years of your life, perhaps multiple decades of your life, by other humans. Like there, we, you know what happens when you find an abandoned child in the forest that's been raised by wolves. It's it's a very strange result. Obviously, humans are extremely shaped by there's people in their lives all the time that are teaching them through their lives. And we recognize the value of this. So we're teaching, you all probably have taught as well. You've taught people, and you've been taught. So this is a critical part of the gardening experience, and then you have friends who it's just the peer support for learning. And so this is all part of the exterior aspects of the project, but at the same time, there's no getting around it. You just have to get down on your knees and dig sometimes, and sometimes you're out in the sun, and it's sweaty, and get a little bit sunburnt and stuff. But at the end, you feel very pleased with yourself by that lovely flower bed or shrubbery that you've put in. So this process of gardening is appealing. Most of you, I think, and there's two parts of gardening. One is it's quite delicious to actually read the seed catalogs in the winter. It's nice to have a good collection of seed catalogs, you know, just by the fire, and just there's no real gardening happening, but there's imagination and the anticipation and the joy, and that is the intellectual apprehension of Dhamma. So as we sit and we talk, you know, listening to a talk, and we're talking about the garden and talking about the Buddha's life, it's kind of the intellectual aspects, the menu. You've gone into a nice restaurant, and the menu itself is like, wow, it's really just nice to read the menu. However, if that's all you do, you will leave hungry. You do want to order the food eventually, and that's in my early experience. I did read a lot of menus and wondered why I was still hungry, and then it dawned on me that this was not a university course. This was not even a game. This is your life. And it's life or death, really. And it's only when our spiritual realization that when we practice meditation and cultivate the larger views of life that it's not a game. It's you are going to die, and you're not an observer on the outside while others climb Everest or something like this. You're, whether you like it or not, you are on the expedition. you signed on to that ship. you woke up on the ship. You don't know how you got shanghaied onto this ship, but that's what it is to be born, is to be thrust into a world where you're as mortal as anybody else. And there's lots of stories about heroes and stuff, but you find out that you are on the voyage, and you have to reflect and calculate. You're not exempt from it. It's not like you are just cooking on the ship. You're on the ship, and it's going in, sailing off into the unknown, and everybody on that ship has got the same situation. It's not just for monks. Sometimes, you know, people are curious about the monk's lifestyle and, oh, you know, how we spend so much time reflecting on these kind of things. And I have to remind them that it's not like, well, monks have to do that because they're going to die. I'm not, you know. So I have a family, so I have to, I have a job, I have a family, so I don't really have to do that, what the monks are doing. Because they're on a kind of a life and death kind of experiment or something, a voyage. But you are too. It's just a matter of that you have other duties on the ship, but you're in the same boat. We're all in the same boat. And so this is the, you know, this is the overarching feeling of the of meditation. Attempts to arrive at ultimate answers to, you know, how should I handle my mortality? How should I handle the uncertain number of days I have left in my life? You know, the maybe a handful of decades if you're lucky, you know. But you're never sure. There's no guarantees, is it? So it's we're looking for a solution under time pressure as well. Pressure of time. And it's all different than science. A science project is really, in the formulas, you know, E equals MC squared, whatever you're working on, they don't use the letter D. And that should be, that's in our little scientific quest, that is the attempt to understand and move on in life and so forth. There's always this, in science experience, they have the T for time, you know, something time, but we have a letter D. Science is immortal. It's not personal. Life is mortal and personal. So in our formula, we got this letter D. So it's like time, uncertainty, and death is like, this is the part of life where we're really realizing that, you know, this is not a game. This is not a science experiment. It's my life, and I have a certain uncertain time of to get it together somehow, and at least to find some element of beauty within my time. I may not find certainty beyond this life about what is if and what is beyond this life, but I do have an opportunity to see how far I could go into the garden in this life with, as I say, a time, there's a very shaky time structure to it. So there's a sense of urgency to this whole thing. So that's what we do in the meditation. It's surrounded, whatever we, our little exercises are, say we do breath meditation or loving kindness meditation or these kind of compassion meditation, meditation on the elements these are inductions for serenity and reflection. It's all in the context that of a very, the very serious matter of our life and our voyage and and the certainty that we cannot, you know, stabilize. We cannot find a house in this life that is going to be there for forever. It's not going to happen. So we're finding a refuge, a shady tree, some that is more than a tree. It's a place that will be there in all situations. So that you're cultivating this kind of clarity of a vision that will be with you in different situations, all the way to the most extreme. Extreme situations are loss and illness, death. These are can be quite intense, and what we want is something there that we can be centered in these kind of passages. So this is the why we do these things, and it's not grim or anything like that, or morbid, or negative. It's actually the opposite, that we can find a quality of ease, peace, the beautiful in the midst of reality, how things really happen. So, you all, anybody not meditated before? For no, so everybody has a kind of a meditative theme that they already have. It's good. If you, I can suggest that if you want to practice today with the air element, you know, the breath is air. It just flows in and out of you, and it's a great one for clearing the mind, tranquilizing the mind, or maybe tranquilizing is not a good a word. Allowing the mind to be serene, and the sort of background anxiety that's kind of part of every day's life to settle. We need our best and clearest emotional conditions to reflect properly. It's not just a clear mind. People do quite amazing things while they're full of anxiety and fear, like writing a final exam or your whole university career is at stake, you know, and you're almost sick with anxiety and fear, and yet you pull it off while your intellect is still functioning. But really to get the right answer, this is more like a written or like an essay test, you know, where you need to express yourself both clearly but also emotionally. And so we are using such things as the breath to allow our basic anxiety to subside. And it's that emotional condition of ease and non-fear that allows us to think in a new way, clarity. And it's not merely thinking, it's kind of convictions arise about how I should lead my life, how I will undertake to comport myself in this life, within my inner life, how I want to walk through this life. So it's when fear and so forth subside, the voice of certainty arises and says, there is no other way to live but this. I refuse to, I shall now participate in civil disobedience. I refuse to live in a jangled, anxious, fearful way. I will not go along with it. So these are the kind of voices that appear with total clarity. And also you will suddenly start remembering lines from poems and stuff. Because these words are, you know, you've heard these things before. But when you feel it yourself, it suddenly, they pop up, little lines from songs, from poems, from things from essays and beautiful sentences from Shakespeare, whatever, pop up because you're now on the same track. You've just passed through the same garden grove as those previous minds. And they left that. They said, this is the most important thing I ever experienced in my life, and I'm going to write this down and just put it in a bottle and throw it out there into the sea. And whoever opens it may not understand it, but perhaps at some point in their life, they also will understand what that note was talking about. So that's, you know, meditation, the serene breath, the cultivation of the heart of loving kindness, or the serenity that rises from contemplating the elements. The breath is also the air element. So just the cooling the machinery of the brain. It's a temperature kind of modulator. It cools things down and allows you to... That feeling of the shade, the image of the Buddha sitting under the spreading Bodhi tree by the river, the breeze coming off there. You can imagine, of course, India is very hot. This was in about this time, May, the month of May, full moon of May, that the Buddha has his awakening, and he's been in a very harsh, he's been practicing some very harsh teachings, some very harsh schools that believe in starving themselves and sitting out in the blazing sun and freezing themselves at night and all kinds of harsh things that are thought to be beneficial in some way, and he's just given up on that. And you can imagine, so it's a huge sense of relief. He decides not to sit in the sun, but to sit in the shade, to sit near the banks of a river where the breeze is and hear the sound of the rushing water. And what happens to him? Which is what happens to us all when our moods are magnets for memories. So he remembers what it's like, what it was like when he was about 4 years old. And he was at a plowing festival. Of course, he's a prince, and he's surrounded by his nurses and his aunts and his people that are attending to him. He's nicely taken care of, and he's under a tree. And that beautiful breeze is blowing. And he's feeling such love and serenity that he enters into what we would call a supernormal condition of ease, peace, joy. This is the samadhi, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, is profound serenity, emotional joy at the same time. So because he's now started to treat himself properly, like more or less like a responsible parent would, he's practicing loving kindness for himself, and the associated memories are coming up, and so of this something which is completely could not have any negative consequences. The ease he felt as a child was blameless. He used the word blameless. So when we're doing this, you know, lightly, freely breathing and so forth, this is blameless. We feel we're not harming any being in the world. We're at ease with ourselves, and we probably will feel associated memories rising from our life from times when we have been at peace and well. And that's a very important experience. So that's the function of these types of meditations, are not only to make you feel well now, but also to kind of see into your past life. I mean, and the story of the Buddha is that he goes deeply into these states of blissful serenity, and then his eye of wisdom awakens. He looks with his eye of wisdom into how things work in life. Flooded with images of how when negativity produces negativity, harshness produces harshness, you know, confusion produces confusion. He sees the cause and effect in greed and in hatred and in delusions. He sees nothing good comes out of those things. And then he sees how generosity and kindness and clarity, everything good comes out of those things. That's his wisdom eye, seeing the cause and effect in the most important aspect of the human experience. Is we might call it ethical, but that's a pretty dry word. It really is where, you know, the heart of the matter. When our speech and action is motivated by a good, kindly, loving, non-fearful kind of heart, not only are we rewarded at that time, but all good results come out of those properly motivated words and actions. So that is the kind of the overarching context of what, you know, what we're trying to do with these meditations. I mean, we got all kinds of technical, and different teachers teach different ways for experiencing your breath here or there or wherever, you know. But at the bottom of it, this is the context for it. So we have to have the, you know, we're gardening, yeah. And everybody's got their own way of, you know, digging radishes or whatever. And everybody makes different salads, you know, and they're nice variety, different fresh garden stuff comes out great. Everybody likes different flowers and different conditions, so each of you are individual, very unique. So you will have different flowerings of different qualities. We just want to be working with our own conditions and trying to produce that sense of abundance and allowing the clearing out of the weeds and parched areas of the garden. So let's just take about 5 or 10 minutes just to stretch your legs, and then we'll come back for a sitting. And if you felt serene from the images from the talk, just keep those. Whenever you get we're keeping the insects and birds away from our lovely little delicate plants, right? So we're keep guarding it. When you get something good, don't just watch it rise and pass away. This might be different than words you've heard before. It's not about watching things rise and pass away. It's about guarding things that are beautiful. Yeah. So if you get anything beautiful, guard it, keep it, nourish it. So for now, let us just stretch the body and feel relief, a little bit of relief as well, changing the postures.